welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 13th of December 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and it's been a week since you've actually heard from Real Britannia, so I'm really looking forward to getting back into it today alongside my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? How's your weekend been?
Well, my weekend's been okay, actually. I've made my annual first foray into Christmas shopping, which I always do, where I buy nothing. And it always then takes like a second and a third foray into the shops before I couldn't find anything. I'm not feeling particularly festive at the moment, actually. There seems to be a sort of a low energy end to the year, generally speaking, I think. I normally am a very like festive person when Christmas comes around, but I'm just not feeling it quite so much this year, that's all.
Well, there's somebody who had a very good Christmas last year while everybody was at home, isn't there? There is Boris Johnson and his Christmas parties, which is all in the news. That we've got a huge scandal on at the moment based on last Christmas, basically, and it is all based upon a video clip of the Prime Minister's press officer basically rehearsing answers to questions. And this is being portrayed as if she was talking about a real party. And it seems to me that she wasn't actually talking about a real party. And we've got this huge scandal because now they've discovered that there were these parties going on last year that the Conservative Party are saying weren't really parties. It was just people that worked together anyway, and they might have had something to eat at the end of the day. But the scandal is that everybody else was not allowed to even meet with their family, let alone go to a Christmas party. And this video has been put out there, and of course, because of that, there's calls for police to investigate it, there's calls for Boris Johnson to go. But the video itself just seems very, very suspicious to me, because it seems to me as if the press officer was being asked questions and she was doing like a rehearsal, and she was rehearsing to answer questions that may get asked to her. Not specific questions on specific things. It was just, what would you do if a journalist asked you this? What would you say if a journalist asked you that? And the question was, what would you say if a journalist asked you if there had been Christmas parties? So she then starts talking about hypothetical Christmas parties. I don't think she was actually talking about a real Christmas party. And this has been portrayed as if she has. And of course, she's been in tears over this. And I must admit, I did think, well, this is quite entertaining, actually, to see the Conservative Party in such distress. She's not a particularly nice lady, this press officer, and she's really in tears because she doesn't like the way that she's been portrayed, more so than I think than anything that she's actually said. So it just seems suspicious to me that the way that this is being portrayed, and it's being investigated as well. And Dellingpole over at Breitbart, he's pointed out the fact that this press office that was being used for this rehearsal, that didn't actually come into use until March this year. So how was it being used at Christmas time? So there's these very suspicious things about this. And as I say, it was a fictional party that she was talking about, and yet it's being portrayed as if it was a real party. And I don't think it was. And like Dellingpole, he was wondering whether this has been deliberately done because Boris Johnson wants to go, and this will give him an excuse to go. And he may actually be right, because it doesn't make sense to me. It's as if it's all not real what she was talking about. I don't know what to make of it, Max. I know you've been looking into this as well, and you've been reading up to date on the newspapers. And I just really thought this the other day. I saw the clip on Red Ice, and it included the beginning of it, and it was very clear that this was not a real party she was talking about. She was being expected to answer questions that may get thrown to her by journalists. So they were trying to catch her out, basically. Like, what would you say if they threw this question at you? So she was joking around and saying, well, at this hypothetical party, I wasn't there. I don't know what went on there, which is the sort of thing that you would expect a press officer to say to deny all knowledge of it. So it just seemed to me like it was... You know, it was play acting. It was just rehearsing. And yet it's been portrayed as if it was real. So what are your thoughts on this? And what do you know of the most up-to-date news on it, Max?
Well, I don't know that I know anything that's sort of really for certain, because there are a lot of allegations that have been made. And so far, none of these allegations have been absolutely proven true. And Allegra Stratton is the lady that you were talking about, who is the press officer concerned. And I thought that the clip of her speaking was a strange clip. She didn't really seem to be answering any direct questions directly. She was just saying things that were like sentences that seemed a little bit disjointed. So I wasn't that impressed by that particular video. But it certainly seems as though somebody who doesn't like Boris Johnson is orchestrating a whole lot of issues that are all associated around Boris Johnson and his alleged either honesty or dishonesty, whichever way around you happen to feel. And I noticed that there was a quite sort of prominently displayed a cartoon which appears to show Boris Johnson from behind sitting on a gate to a field, and where people have used this term Watergate, with gate on the end of anything that turns out to be a bit of a scandal for a government. And so this gate has got several bars going across it, one of which says Afghan dog airlift gate. Another one says COVID plan B gate. Next one down says Downing Street wallpaper gate. And then there's Christmas party gate, of course. And then in the distance, you can see a pair of trousers that are on fire. And so this is kind of like pants on fire. And the cartoon is given the title Liargate. And so, you know, that cartoon, which actually is quite an amusing cartoon, produced by Chris Riddell for The Observer. We've had Dominic Cummings appearing to suggest that that there was indeed a party at Number 10 at some point during last December when it was not legal. There has been the appearance of a photograph, and I think this was in the Daily Mirror or on the Mirror website, and this is a photograph showing Boris Johnson sitting between two colleagues allegedly hosting a Christmas quiz at Number 10. It isn't quite clear from the photograph, though, whether, you know, quite what's going on, because there's precious little by way of Christmas decorations. It's a still photograph and not a piece of video. And so, again, you can't really see what's being said. If you were pro Boris Johnson, you could give one particular version of, you know, what that picture actually shows. If you were anti Boris Johnson, you could give another completely different account of what that picture actually shows. But I think that there's a lot of agitation within the Conservative Party, and that there appears to be a certain amount of jostling for position as people are anticipating that there perhaps might be a vote of no confidence. There's been accounts in the news alleging that various Conservative MPs have started writing to the chairman of the 1922 committee. And of course, once a certain number of people have written to the chairman of the 1922 committee asking for a leadership election, then a leadership election is triggered. And so I think we're sort of heading into a period now where Boris is under attack by people who would appear to have been perfectly content to, you know, if indeed all of these things are true that are alleged that Boris has been involved in, then the people who are now revealing these allegations have been quite content to sit on them for a year before making them apparent, and have now sort of chosen this particular time to make all this information available, which is, somewhat suspicious. but it certainly appears that there are a number of people who are out sharpening their knives with a view to doing Boris down. Now, whether Boris is actually trying to slip away and resign from his prime ministerial position, I wouldn't know. I would doubt that very much in view of the fact that to become prime minister was a lifelong ambition of his. And it just seems strange that he doesn't simply decide that he's going to resign and spend more time with his family. You know, that's the sort of thing that politicians come up with, and he could quite easily come up with that. So I don't see that this is Boris damning himself or bringing all this deliberately upon himself in order to leave the centre stage of British politics. It seems to me that it's far more likely that this is a lot of stuff which is now being brought out in a fairly sort of orchestrated way in order to create a mother of all crises for Boris over the Christmas period, and in the hope of forcing some kind of leadership election within the Conservative Party.
Well, yeah, there's also rebellion from the backbenches over the coronavirus as well, because he's saying people should be working from home if they can. People have got to wear masks again, and there's all these complaints of what's this going to do for the economy. And what it really says to me is if this party was going on last year and they were having these parties while everybody else was told to stay at home, then surely that means that all these restrictions that we had, they're just a scam. They're just a scam to make people believe that the government are doing something about this coronavirus, and they don't even believe in them themselves. And yet nobody is saying that. When you look at what's going on with the talk shows on the television, it's all people calling in saying this is terrible, Boris Johnson should be sacked, how dare they do all of this while everybody else was at home, not able to see their families, not able to go and see them in hospital. But not one person have I seen on the television saying, well surely this means that all these restrictions didn't mean anything. They're not going to wearing a mask is not going to prevent you from catching coronavirus. You know, the moisture in the breath that just passes through these masks, so that there's no point in wearing them. And surely, if you're working with people during the day, it's not going to make any difference. If you go to a Christmas party with them at night, it's the same people that you're actually with. But nobody's pointing out that the inconsistency between these guidelines that they're actually giving out. And it does seem as if they are going particularly after Boris Johnson recently. There was also his performance at the Economic Forum, where he forgot what he was talking about, lost his place in his pages of his notes, and started going on about Peppa Pig, bizarrely, and even messing his hair up and tussling his hair didn't carry the day. So he does look as if they are sort of making him look as if he's losing control. The photograph, I believe, that you were referring to there, where he is with two other people, I think that was him reading out a quiz for the Christmas party, but that was supposedly by Zoom. It was supposed to be a Zoom call to the various people that worked for him while they were at home, and he was doing this Christmas quiz for them. So that's fairly believable. I don't think he was actually at any of these parties. And the original video where this Stratton woman is answering these questions, the people that are asking her the questions are members of her own team. They're not actually journalists. They're play acting as journalists, just asking the sort of questions that might be asked. So it does seem to me as if that clip is being misused in some way to try and provoke all of this and to get the public whipped up into a fury. And we've had the Labour Party that have reported Boris Johnson to the police for this and are expecting him to be investigated. And of course, that's a complete pantomime as well, because the police work for the government. They're not going to investigate the government and find him guilty of having parties, are they? I mean, it's the government that are the ones that are making these laws. It's just a pantomime to think that the police are actually going to seriously investigate it, don't you think?
Well, I think constitutionally one would expect the police to investigate it, in my view. And this is one of the most suspicious aspects of all of this, which is that I believe that the response that's come back from the Metropolitan Police is that there is insufficient evidence, and so they're not going to investigate. This is the Christmas party gate sort of allegation. They're not going to investigate it. But the thing that people haven't yet sort of latched onto is that there is always a uniformed police officer stood outside of number 10. There are also usually a couple of uniformed police officers stood at the gates to Downing Street, just, you know, 25 yards down the road, who can, you know, see who goes in and who comes out of number 10 Downing Street. So it is strange that none of these police officers who were being told at the time that they should clamp down on anybody who was not, you know, who's failing to uphold the COVID regulations, none of these police officers thought of reporting the fact that parties were taking place at number 10 Downing Street. And so, you know, whilst there are these various people, as I say, who've come forward and made these allegations, none of them have made allegations with sufficient evidence to make it stick. As far as the police are concerned, they've kind of looked into it in a fairly sort of cursory way and then decided that they're not going to investigate it further. And the people would know, the police officers who would be standing outside 10 Downing Street, they would know. Also, the close protection squad that follow the Prime Minister wherever he goes, you know, I think he's always got at least one or two armed bodyguards with him wherever he goes. You know, they would have known whether there was a party taking place. And so if the Metropolitan Police wanted evidence, there must be evidence by the bucket load. If indeed these parties did take place in the way that they are alleged to. Plus, you can't tell me that there are no CCTV cameras along Downing Street. There must be some. I mean, I don't think I've ever been to Downing Street, but I can't imagine that there wouldn't be any CCTV cameras along Downing Street and around the back of the buildings where they sort of go off towards Horse Guards Parade. And so if the police wanted to go round and collect that CCTV evidence, if there were lots of comings and goings with like 50 odd people attending parties at number 10 Downing Street, then it would be very easy to accumulate the evidence to prove it. The fact that they've said the evidence doesn't exist, well, you could interpret that as being the police not wanting to upset their political masters. But by the same token, we're supposed to live in a democracy where various institutions of government are independent of each other and do operate independently of each other. And one would have thought that at least one police officer would have had the integrity, if these parties had been taking place, to come forward and say, well, actually, there is loads of evidence and, you know, I've got it here. Here it is. And so it is a bit of a mystery. But I think the main thing for us to take from all of this is that whoever it is who was orchestrating the silence with regard to all of these things during the course of the last year, and who didn't feel that it was appropriate to reveal any of this evidence over the course of the last year, has suddenly now decided that it is an appropriate time for all these things to be aired and for all these allegations and accusations to be made against the Prime Minister. And so the really interesting thing of all this is, who has Boris Johnson upset so much, who is such a powerful person that they can bend the will of the mass media in this country to the extent that it appears that the mass media are being kind of led around with a ring through their nose. Who is this person that Boris Johnson has upset?
Well, you know, it reminds me a little bit of what happened in Austria with the Austrian Freedom Party. And there was an MP, and he was caught talking to this Russian woman. It was a pretend rich Russian businesswoman. And he was saying if they got into power, that they would make laws that would benefit this Russian businesswoman, basically. And the journalists sat on that for 2 years. And they waited until just before the election, and then they published this at the election, and it destroyed the Freedom Party's chances of winning in the election. So it's a similar thing here, isn't it? They've had this all year, and they've waited to use it, and now they're using it at Christmas time for maximum effect. And it could be because they're just trying to remind people of what happened last Christmas. We weren't able to go out, and yet Boris Johnson was having this party. But it could also be that it is somebody powerful that is actually against all these COVID regulations, and they could be bringing it out now to say, look, Boris Johnson is trying to force through more COVID regulations, and yet he doesn't even believe in them himself. Look at what was happening a year ago. And they were having these parties. Because at the moment, Boris Johnson is saying we need to have a talk about forced vaccinations, mandated vaccinations like they're having in Austria and in Germany. And Sajid Javid has said, well, no, I don't think we should be doing that. But people don't really listen to Sajid Javid, do they? They listen to Boris Johnson. And there is a rebellion against his coronavirus regulations in the Tory party. So it may be somebody to do with the Tory party that's actually doing this. Because how else would they have access to that video? It had to have been leaked by somebody within the Tory party, and they must be being protected. I mean, I'm surprised they haven't said we need to have a big investigation to find out who it is that has actually leaked this. I mean, have you heard of that at all?
I think the video that was taken of Allegra Stratton at that lectern was taken by an independent media company who were advising the Conservative Party with regard to
answer questions.
And effectively respond to media questioning of this sort. So it's like a public relations kind of company that was giving them instruction on their public relations technique and their question answering technique. So,
That was pretty stupid. If that's what it was, and they were really talking about breaking the law and having these parties, I mean, that would have been really stupid of them. That's why it makes me think they're not actually talking about real parties. And this is being construed in that way deliberately for some reason, because you wouldn't do that, would you, in front of an independent media company, admit breaking the law and joke about it.
And Allegra Stratton, in the statement that she made, and she was very tearful in that statement, and sufficiently tearful for me to suspect she was probably telling the truth, didn't actually state that she was talking about an actual party that took place. She was apologising for the fact that she had referred to the COVID rules in a way that was that she felt has been was in hindsight was disrespectful, and so that's what she was apologising for, and that's the reason for her resignation, not the fact that she felt that she had revealed the fact that there was in fact a party. And so again, you know, her tearful resignation has been misinterpreted by the media in order to put the worst spin on it possible from the point of view of the government.
That's what they do, isn't it? They do deliberately misinterpret things. I mean, there's so many times I've seen it happen where the media will deliberately misinterpret something that somebody has said and whip up a complete furor over it, and just to get the public angry about things, and then try to manipulate the government to do what the media wants it to do. And at the same time, you see the government using the media to manipulate the public in the ways that the government want the media to do. It's hard to sort of tell where one ends and the other begins sometimes. I mean, I as I say, I don't know what to make of this, but I think what we will find out is that this Allegra Stratton, she hadn't actually been to a party, that this was just her answering these questions, but that there possibly were get-togethers of people that were working together with each other during the day anyway, and they just turned up for the evening for maybe nibbles or whatever. Because, I mean, if you're working in the government, you're going to be working 24 hours a day, aren't you, pretty much? They're going to be or 16 hours a day in the same with the same people. And whether, you know, at Christmas time, you also have a little bit of alcohol and you have some cheese and biscuits or whatever with the same people, it's not going to really make that much of a difference. It's not like it's, you know, a huge party where they've hired out a hall or anything like that. It's in the same premises. But it is being used, as I say, it's being used to have a go at Boris Johnson. And it should really be used to show that they didn't really have the same respect for these regulations that they've told us that we should be having for them, because they don't work. They're not going to protect you from coronavirus. A mask is not going to protect you. Keeping everybody locked in didn't stop the coronavirus. And that's the point, I think, that people should be taking away from this. I know our listeners understand that anyway.
Yeah, I do agree with that, and it's it's always been presented that Boris Johnson is the sort of, you know, he's the conservative who's got the common touch and is able to galvanise the red wall later, you know, lifelong Labour Party voters to actually vote for the Conservative Party. And, you know, there's always talk as well in the press at the moment about how he's always been regarded as being Teflon coated in the past, so that, you know, nothing sticks to him. He always manages to sort of his kind of genial humour, etc., to steer himself back out of trouble when trouble has come his way, as if, you know, this ability of his has suddenly deserted him. And my conclusion is that either Boris Johnson personally has annoyed somebody, or a group of people who are very, or perhaps a group of people, or an individual who is very pleased at what Keir Starmer is doing with the Labour Party, is paving the way for a Labour general election victory in the not too distant future, with a view to replacing the current Conservative administration with a Labour Party that will be, it's difficult to imagine how anybody could really be worse than the current Conservative Party. But I imagine when I look at the various faces that rather than the Labour Party, that it would be very easy for the Labour Party to produce an administration that would be far worse than the current Conservative administration.
Each time I see Keir Starmer recently, I keep thinking to myself, his eyes are far too close together. He really doesn't look very trustworthy to me. Well, we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that. Maybe there will be a leadership challenge in the next few weeks. Anyway, I don't know, was there anything else that you wanted to pick up on from the week's news, Max, or should we get into our Greatest Britons?
Well, let's talk about Captain Scott again, yes.
Yeah, let's get more into Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition. And in the last episode, we heard how when the Terra Nova finally got to the Antarctic and started unloading, the first of the bad luck set in, with one of the motor sledges falling through the ice. Soon after this, they discovered the ponies did not suit the snow, and only one set of snowshoes had been left with them, the rest going off with the ship to Cape Evans. And we wondered what the snowshoes looked like, and we thought they might be in a capital D shape. But I had a look on Google Images, and they looked more similar to wheels to me. But I was just looking at one image, and it was just sort of showing you one snowshoe that was in a wheel shape. And you were telling me that there were others that were in a D shape, and it might have been the wheel shape that was at the front and the D shape that was at the back, Max. Is that correct?
Yes. After we'd spoken about this before, I Googled snowshoes for horses, and it appeared that there were two types. The circular snowshoes, where the horse's hoof would have been in the centre of the circle, so it would therefore just make the contact patch much larger. But it appeared to me that the snowshoes on the rear feet of the horse were in the D shape. And I think from the conversation we had before, I'd mentioned that how the rear hooves of horses almost clip each other as horses walk. You know, their rear feet seem to be closer together than their front feet are. And so that could well be that there would be two different shapes of shoe for the horses.
So you'd have a front shoe and a back shoe. So that solves that problem that we were asking about in the last episode. The dogs fell down a crevasse, and after Scott rescued them, they then attacked the ponies. Only one of the ponies survived, and to top everything off, the expedition's main competitor, Amundsen, had arrived with perfectly trained dogs and a plan to head for the pole in the summer from a much closer position than Scott's starting point. Finally, even more ponies died, this time after floating out on a block of ice and being harassed by killer whales. So things really have not taken a turn for the better once they actually arrived there in the Antarctic. And now we will continue with our story here. Now they waited at Hut Point for the sea ice to freeze over again so they could continue on to Cape Evans. On March the 15th, they were joined by the geologists Griffith Taylor, Frank Debenham and Charles Wright, along with Petty Officer Edgar Evans, who had been exploring the Western Mountains in Victoria Land. On April the 11th, Scott and half the party were able to get away for Cape Evans with the rest to follow. When they reached the base, they found the hut in good shape, but one of the ponies and another dog had died. That left just 10 ponies for them out of the original 19. On April 23rd, the sun vanished beneath the horizon for the last time until August. Scott wrote that the sledging season had come to an end, that is, except for one trip led by Wilson to Cape Crozier in search of birds. And that adventure is best told in a book written by Cherry Garrard, The Worst Journey in the World. A great deal of scientific work was accomplished during the winter at Cape Evans. Scott's diary is full of scientific data. He was constantly thinking and observing as he went on solitary walks, recording all the things seen. He had a passion for science and was sensitive to nature and beauty alike. His spiritual growth was boundless. And we have a quote here. There is infinite suggestion in this phenomenon, the Aurora Borealis. Mysterious, no reality. It is the language of mystic signs and of portents, the inspiration of the gods. Wholly spiritual, divine signalling. Needless to say, hours and hours of preparation were put into the plans for the push to the pole, but always his thoughts came back to transport, as during the winter, three more dogs had died. Six men missing from the hut at Cape Evans were Victor Campbell and his five companions, who, having failed to get ashore on King Edward VII Land, had been taken by the Terra Nova to Cape Adare, where they established their base near Borch Grevink's old camp. The Eastern Party had thus become the Northern Party, and it had been arranged that the Terra Nova would pick up Campbell's party from Cape Adare on her return from New Zealand in early 1912. So it's interesting here that we see that he's appreciating the beauty there and the spiritual side of it. And I guess you would have a lot of solitude there as well as the camaraderie with the people. And during the winter, there's really not that much for them to do. They're just there waiting for the summer to come when they can make this attempt on the pole. And also, don't forget, we've got Amundsen, who is much closer to the South Pole now, and he's going to make his journey in the summer as well. So there must have been a lot of thoughts going around his head. And when you imagine half the ponies have died and a lot of the dogs as well, he's really not starting out with the best of resources to actually get there.
It certainly is a process of attrition that they're going through, and it is taking them a long time to make the preparations for the journey south to try and get to the South Pole. And part of the, they haven't spent a lot of time thinking, and it's probably a good job that they do have some time to think, because that they would need to then plan to make up for the losses that they would have suffered as a result of this attrition.
And it's also good that we have all these diaries and journals that they kept, so we can get an understanding of what they were going through. Geology, with 25-year-old Raymond Priestley in charge, was to be the main preoccupation, and surgeon Murray Levick was to study birds and marine life. So the winter at Cape Evans passed. Scott celebrated his 43rd birthday with his companions, and he wrote, "They are boys, all of them, but such excellent, good-natured ones. There has been no sign of sharpness or anger, no jarring note in all these wordy contests. All end with a laugh." A Discovery Expedition custom Scott revived was the issue of the South Polar Times. The sun returned on Victor Campbell's 36th birthday, August the 23rd, and Scott fixed the date of departure for the pole as November the 1st, 1911, at the latest. They could not start earlier because the ponies would not survive the cold. So to fill in the time, Scott, Bowers, Simpson and Edgar Evans left on September the 15th on a remarkably pleasant and instructive little spring journey to the Western Mountains. It was probably on this trip that Scott picked his companions for the final push to the pole. Wilson was a given, Edgar Taff Evans too, the sterling sledger, strong as an ox. Bowers, the only man Scott could rely on to grasp details and remember them. And he says, "The greatest source of pleasure to me is to realise that I have such men as Bowers and P.O. Evans for the southern journey." But at the end of October 1911, Scott called his men together to give them some bad news. The expedition was under heavy financial strain and had literally run out of funding. those men capable of foregoing their salary for the coming year were asked to do so. Some had already decided to return with the Terra Nova when she called in that summer. Griffith Taylor was expected back at his university. Ponting and Day's work was finished, while Clissold and Ford were in poor health. Most of the others volunteered to stay another winter, even if they received no pay. I mean, this is shocking, isn't it? You know, you think today if you're going out on a scientific mission, the government are going to pay you for it. But they've gone out on this mission. They've had to get all private funding for it. And now they've run out of the funding. And he's just asking people to volunteer. At least on that first discovery expedition, it was all paid for by the government. It was all paid for by the Navy. I mean, do you imagine going for a year without pay in these conditions?
Mind you, I suppose having become part of the party and having gone down there and endured what they have endured, it would become a kind of mission that you would have. I mean, it obviously was a mission as far as Scott was concerned, that he was prepared to sort of put his life on the line to achieve. But also the other people, they would also, you know, living in close proximity with him for that length of time, they would have probably become equally obsessed with the mission of being the first people to get to the South Pole. And I can imagine that somebody, if they were going to be fed and they were going to and that they were so close to achieving their objective, that, you know, just one more final push would do it. I can imagine people being prepared to do that for nothing.
Well, it was a very, very important expedition that they were on. And of course, they wanted to be the first there as well. They wanted to beat Amundsen. Before the departure of the Southern Party, Scott, like all the others, wrote to his family and friends. He acknowledged in his letter to Kathleen, "I don't know what to think of Amundsen's chances. If he gets to the pole, it must be before we do, as he is bound to travel fast with dogs and pretty certain to start early. On this account, I decided at a very early date to act exactly as I should have done had he not existed. Any attempt to race must have wrecked my plan, besides which it doesn't appear the sort of thing one is out for. You can rely on my not saying or doing anything foolish, only I'm afraid you must be prepared for finding our venture much belittled. After all, it is the work that counts, not the applause that follows." Scott wrote on the last page of the diary that he left behind, "The future is in the lap of the gods. I can think of nothing left undone to deserve success." And on November the 1st, 1911, the time came for the start of his last journey. The first to leave Cape Evans were Day, Lashley, Teddy Evans and Hooper with the motor sledges, while the others with ponies and dogs followed behind. One machine gave out just beyond safety camp, while the other had to be abandoned a mile behind corner camp. On November the 1st, 10 men, each with a pony and a sledge, left Cape Evans in detachments. Scott, Wilson, Bowers, Oates, Atkinson, Cherry Garrard, Wright, Edgar Evans, Crean and Keir Hayne. Mears and Dimitri followed with the dogs. Everyone else remained at Cape Evans to carry out further exploration and research in Victoria Land. Scott assumed the Terra Nova would return in January, bringing Victor Campbell and his northern party back to Cape Evans, whereby Campbell would take command. The distance from Hut Point to the pole and back was 1,766 statute miles, and every step of the way had to be marched on foot, with or without skis. They travelled by night for the benefit of the ponies, while temperatures never rose above 0 Fahrenheit. Fighting constant snowfall, the team reached One Ton Camp on the 15th day. There was a constant worry that the ponies would give out, and upon reaching Camp 20 on November 24th, the first pony was killed. Four camps later, on December the 1st, the second pony was shot. I mean, so the motor sledges that they brought, they've all completely failed. Half the ponies have died. Now the ponies, the ones that they've got left, are dying. A lot of the dogs have died. I mean, really, you would think maybe he should have actually thought, well, we're going to have to give this a miss. But I think he was just so desperate to get there And he had that faith that because he was so certain he was going to do it, he was going to make it. But really, I think, you know, all the signs were there that perhaps he should have thought again, really, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right there. But again, sort of going back to the length of time that they've spent there doing this and the fact that it's been an obsession for them all, and that they're all living in close proximity in a kind of hothouse kind of environment, they would all have the same degree of like fanatical determination, and that obviously is what was driving them on.
But they're doing it all under their own steam now. That's the thing. I mean, they're literally having to walk to the pole, whereas the plan was to have ponies and motor sledges and dogs, and they're literally having to walk. Depots were made at regular intervals of roughly 70 miles, each containing food and fuel for a week for the returning parties. Scott wrote on December the 3rd, "Our luck in weather is preposterous. The conditions are simply horrible." On December the 5th, they awoke to a blizzard. The temperature normally rose just before and during a blizzard, but in this case, the temperature rose exceptionally high, resulting in melting snow, making everything wet. Scott wrote, "One cannot see the next tent, let alone the land. What on earth does such weather mean at this time of the year? It is more than our share of ill fortune, but the luck may turn yet." The wet, warm blizzard kept them confined to their tents for the next 4 days. This event quite likely led to their deaths. If they had not lost these 4 days, they would have reached one-ton depot ahead of the blizzard that kept them pinned in at their last camp. On the third day of the blizzard, Scott wrote, "Resignation to misfortune is the only attitude, but not one easy to adopt. It is very evil to lie here in a wet sleeping bag and think of the pity of it whilst things go steadily from bad to worse." On the fifth day, the blizzard let up enough for the men to break camp. They had to beat the ponies as they floundered up to their bellies. And Wilson wrote, "Constantly collapsed and lay down and sank down, and eventually we could only get them on 5 or 6 yards at a time. They were clean done." They struggled for 11 hours, after which time the party camped. 5 ponies were shot, skinned, and made into a depot. Wilson wrote, "Thank God the horses are now all done for and we begin the heavier work ourselves." 2 days later found them on the foot of the Beardmore Glacier, and after setting up the lower glacier depot, Mears and Dimitri started back with the dogs and the mail. Day and Hooper had already turned back, so a party of 12, divided into groups, set out to man-haul the sledges up the glacier towards the summit, 10,000 feet above. Amundsen, unfortunately, was already there. The glacier is over 100 miles long and in some places 40 miles wide. The struggle began with each man pulling over 200 pounds through the soft snow, which they sank into nearly up to their knees. Some suffered from snow blindness as others stumbled into crevasses, sledges, and all. On December the 13th, the day before Amundsen actually reached the pole, in 9 hours, the party had advanced less than 4 miles. Scott wrote, "I had pinned my faith on getting better conditions as we rose, but it looks as though matters are getting worse instead of better." Bowers wrote that he had never pulled so hard or so nearly crushed my inside into my backbone by the everlasting jerking with all my strength on the canvas band around my unfortunate tummy. The situation gradually improved as they scaled the glacier, and on December the 20th, Scott named the first returning party: Atkinson, Wright, Cherry Garrard, and Keohane. Scott had dreaded this moment, as all had pulled to the limit of their strength, but now 4 good men had to be deprived of their just reward, the pole. The next day, the men established Upper Glacier Depot at 7,000 feet. After completion, the first supporting party left for home and reached Hut Point 35 days later, on January 26, 1912. The 2 remaining groups went on with 2 sledges and 12 weeks' supply of oil and fuel, pulling £190 per man. In Scott's group were Oates, Wilson and Taff Evans, while Bowers had Teddy Evans, Lashley and Crean. They went on climbing for another 16 days to reach their highest altitude at 10,570 feet. I'll just stop there. You imagine that, pulling 190 pounds. Yeah. I mean, that's the weight of two men, isn't it, that they're dragging in the snow on a sled?
Well, it's the weight of a big man, I would say. About 14 stone, I would say that would be, something cool. Like that.
14 stone, dragging that in deep snow and making about 4 miles a day going uphill on a glacier. I mean, these guys are tough, aren't they? On Christmas Day, with a strong wind in their faces, they advanced 17 and a half miles. The Christmas meal consisted of pony hoosh, ground biscuit, a chocolate hoosh made from cocoa, sugar, biscuit and raisins, thickened with arrowroot, 2.5 square inches each of plum duff, a pannikin of cocoa, 4 caramels each and 4 pieces of crystallized ginger. From here, they made remarkable marches of 14 to 17 miles a day. On January 3rd, Scott chose 4 men to continue with him to the pole and instructed the other 3 to return. Bowers was brought into his tent and Teddy Evans, Lashley and Crean would become the 2nd returning support party. Teddy Evans was very bitter about Scott's decision, but the rest of the crew knew it was a proper choice. Aboard ship, he was of great help, but on land, he was a failure. Wilson wrote, "I never thought for a moment he would be in the final party." Bowers wrote, "Poor Teddy, I am sure it was for his wife's sake he wanted to go. He gave me a little silk flag she had given him to fly on the pole." Lashley and Crean were both in tears as the 3 men turned back at 87 degrees 32 seconds south at an altitude of 10,280 feet and 169 miles from the pole. There was no sign of the Norwegians as Scott and the others followed Shackleton's route. On January 6th, they crossed the line of latitude where Shackleton had turned back and were further south, as they believed, than any man had been before. For the next few days, the going was difficult. On January 9th, they stayed in their bags all day as a blizzard roared outside. On January 10th, they resumed their march, made a depot of 1 week's provisions, and reckoned that they were only 97 miles from the pole. On this day came the first hint that everyone was growing tired. Scott wrote, "I never had such pulling. All the time the sledge rasps and creaks. We have covered 6 miles, but at a fearful cost to ourselves. Another hard grind in the afternoon, and 5 miles added. About 74 miles from the pole. Can we keep this up for 7 days? It takes it out of us like anything. None of us ever had such hard work before. Our chance still holds good if we can put the work in, but it is a terribly trying time." A day later, he wrote, "It is an effort to keep up the double figures, but if we can do another 4 marches, we ought to get through. It is going to be a close thing." 2 days later, despite higher temperatures, Scott wrote, "It is most unaccountable why we should suddenly feel the cold in this manner." On January 13th, they crossed the 89th parallel. Next day, they started to descend and made their final depot of 4 days' food. Scott wrote, "We ought to do it now." And this was the last cheerful entry in Scott's diary. The next day, January 16th, they made a good march and figured they would reach the pole the following day. In the afternoon, Bowers spotted something ahead which looked like a cairn. Half an hour later, they realised the black speck to be a flag tied to part of a sledge. Nearby were the remains of a camp, along with tracks made by sledges and dogs, many dogs. Scott wrote, "This told us the whole story. The Norwegians have forestalled us and are first to the pole." Scott felt he had let his loyal companions down and had utterly failed them, and he wrote in his diary, "Many thoughts come and much discussions have we had. All the daydreams must go. It will be a wearisome return." And I'll just pause there, because you can imagine the effect this is going to actually have on their morale. They're already right at the end of their energy. And it's only the thought that they're going to be the first people at the pole that is keeping them going. They're miles away from the camp that they've actually headed out from. And now they've suddenly got this realization that they've actually been beaten there. So morale is going to be right at the bottom, and they're already starting to feel the fatigue from dragging these sledges all this way. I mean, that must have been absolutely heartbreaking for them to see this cairn there.
Yeah, they've already described the intense physical effort that was involved in dragging those sleds, and to have endured that for days and days on end, and endured the blizzards that they have done, all the other trials and tribulations that we've talked about, it must have been absolutely gutting to find that the Norwegians had beaten them.
Absolutely crushing. And then what do you do then? I guess do you keep on going, or do you turn back? On January 17th, a force 5 gale struck them, along with temperatures falling to 54 degrees of frost. Oates, Evans and Bowers all suffered from severe frostbite as they made an early lunch camp. Scott wrote, "Great God, this is an awful place, and terrible enough for us to have laboured to it without the reward of priority. Well, it is something to have got here, and the wind may be our friend tomorrow." Wilson wrote that it was a tiring day, and despite Amundsen having beaten us in so far as he has made a race of it, we have done what we came for all the same, and as our programme was made out. The next morning they found the Norwegians' camp about 2 miles away. Inside the tent was a sheet of paper with 5 names on it. Roald Amundsen, Olaf Olafsson Bjaaland, Hilmer Hansen, Sverre H. Hassel and Oscar Wisting. The date of the note was December the 14th, 1911. They had taken 21 days less than Scott's party to reach the pole. They had arrived at the pole with their dogs via a glacier they had named the Axel Heiberg. On the day Scott and his companions arrived at the pole, Amundsen and his men were only 1 week out from their winter quarters in the Bay of Wales. The 5 men reached the Fram in the Bay of Wales on January 25th, 1912. In the Norwegian tent, Amundsen left a note for Scott and a letter to be delivered to King Haakon. Bowers took photographs, and then they marched 7 miles south-southeast to a spot which put them within half a mile of the pole, altitude 9,500 feet. Here they built a cairn, planted our poor slighted Union Jacks and the rest of the flags, photographed themselves, and headed for home. Scott wrote, "Well, we have turned our backs now on the goal of our ambition with sore feelings and must now face 800 miles of solid dragging and goodbye to the daydreams." The return trip started out fairly well, but the temperatures were obviously becoming colder. Scott wrote, "There is no doubt that Evans is a good deal run down." On January 23rd, they had to camp early because of frostbite to Evans' nose. Oates' feet were always cold, and when a blizzard held them up 7 miles short of the next food depot, Scott wrote, "I don't like the look of it. Is the weather breaking up? If so, God help us with the tremendous summit journey and scant food." Despite the delays and difficult travel, the marches were good, but they were becoming very tired, as evidenced by the many injuries due to falls. Wilson strained a leg tendon and had to limp painfully beside the sledge for several days. Scott fell and bruised his shoulder, and Evans' hand lost 2 fingernails. On February 7th, they reached the head of the Beardmore Glacier, and the next day they started their descent. On February 11th, in difficult conditions, they took a wrong turn and ended up in the worst ice mess they had ever been in. For the next 2 days, they stumbled around in a maze of ridges, growing more weak and despondent. They knew the next depot could not be far away, but they simply couldn't find it. When they were down to their last meal, the men accidentally came upon the depot, which was shrouded in fog. Scott wrote, "The relief was inexpressible. There is no getting away from the fact that we are not pulling strong." At this point, it was determined to reduce rations since they were not making the distance between depots in a timely manner. And this only weakened them further, as Evans began losing heart and was nearly broken down in brain, we think. On February 16th, Evans collapsed and camp had to be made. But next day he felt better and said he could go on. But he would march for a while and then stop to adjust his boots while the others went on. But when he failed to catch up, the others would go back, only to find him kneeling in the snow with a wild look in his eyes. His companions sledged him to the next camp, and soon after midnight, he died. After a few hours' rest, they were on their way again. At the foot of the glacier, they reached the pony meet and enjoyed their first full meal since leaving the plateau. "New life seems to come with greater food almost immediately," they would write. From here, the travelling became difficult as the snow became very soft. "Pray God we get better travelling as we are not so fit as we were, and the season advances apace." They left the foot of the glacier on February 19th, and on the 27th, Wilson's diary stopped. Bowers had given up on his on January the 25th. They arrived at the Southern Barrier Depot 6 days later. Here they discovered a shortage of oil, presumably due to evaporation from the poorly sealed one-gallon tins. Another 70 miles brought them to the Middle Barrier Depot, where they once again discovered a short supply of oil. By this time, Oates could no longer conceal his pain. His toes were black and gangrene was setting in. Temperatures were down to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and the surface was so bad that even a strong wind in the sail would not move the sledge. Scott wrote, "God help us, we can't keep up this pulling, that is certain. Among ourselves, we are unendingly cheerful, but what each man feels in his heart, I can only guess." On March the 7th, Scott mentions the dogs for the first time. "We hope against hope that the dogs have been to Mount Hooper, the next depot, because then we might pull through. If there is a shortage of oil again, we can have little hope. I should like to keep the track to the end." On the same day, the dogs, driven by Cherry Garrard and Dimitri, were actually waiting at One Ton Depot, some 72 miles from Mount Hooper. On March the 9th, Scott and his men reached Mount Hooper. Cold comfort, shortage on our allowance all around. The dogs, which would have been our salvation, have evidently failed. An unusual northwest wind kept them in camp the next day, as it was simply too cold to face. With half-cooked food, all of them getting frostbitten, and all knowing they were doomed, they discussed the situation. Months before, at Cape Evans, they had discussed what to do if one of them became so injured as to not be able to continue on. Wilson carried lethal doses of morphine in his medicine chest, so one could eliminate himself if the situation called for it. At this point, Scott ordered Wilson to hand over the drugs, so Wilson handed each man his 30 opium tablets. But they were never used, as suicide was against the code. Things got worse as the north wind continued to blow in their faces. Wilson was now becoming weak, so Scott and Bowers had to make camp by themselves. The temperature fell to minus 43 degrees Fahrenheit, and on March the 16th or the 17th, because they lost track of the days, Oates said he could not go on and just wanted to be left in his sleeping bag. The others refused, and he struggled on. There was a blizzard blowing in the morning when Oates said, "I am just going outside and may be some time," and he stumbled out of the tent. Scott wrote, "We knew that poor Oates was walking to his death, but though we tried to dissuade him, we knew it was the act of a brave man and an English gentleman. Oates was never to be seen again." Yeah, this is really moving stuff, isn't it, Max? Very, very moving stuff.
Very, very sad, very moving, yeah. And you can imagine just the atmosphere in their camp would have taken on an almost surreal quality, where they would each of them know that they were doomed, and each of them making their own decision as to how they were going to end things.
Yeah, it's like the complete opposite of all the jubilation that's kept them going so far, that's given them all the endurance, and then to have all their hopes have been dashed, and then they're making their way back, and things are just going wrong one after the other. I mean, I think that since the start of the journey, when the sledges fell through the ice, I think that was, you know, that was the first of the bad omens. But it's just been one piece of bad luck after the other. And they really, once they knew that Amundsen was camped in the Bay of Wales and he was only 1 week from the South Pole and he was going to go for the South Pole, they should have just thought, well, that's it, we're beaten. But they wanted to keep going. They wanted to make it. They did make it to the pole. They just weren't the first ones there. They made it there. They planted the flags, which was the important thing. And it's just it's just making it back now. And yes, we know what happened. But I think we should leave it there. And we'll have a look at the final letters that were written next week, I think. Unless there's anything else you want to add, Max?
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, there's lots of talk nowadays about mental health and mental well-being, and you have princes talking about their mental health, and but these men that accompanied Scott, so Scott and his band of men here were in a different league in terms of toughness to the sort of people that we see taking centre stage in Britain today. You know, these men were real men.
Absolutely. I mean, their sense of purpose, willpower, endurance is just absolutely incredible. As I say, we will hear the final bits of the story in the next episode. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.